All right, we should get started. So this is our Spheres discussion group, Spheres reading group, our third meeting. And we're discussing chapter 2 on Between Faces. And I thought that, unlike in the previous two calls, maybe I could suggest a kind of overarching format for the discussion. To ground it a little bit more in the text itself and get us on the same page before we move into other directions, associations we may have, personal reflections, and so on. And so what I would suggest is that we begin, as before, with John, you giving your overview or introduction to the chapter. But then we go from there to really get on the same page as a group in terms of what we understand Sloterdijk to be saying in the pages, in the text itself. Ed had made the suggestion in the forum, and I think it was a good one. And then from there, once we have that resonance and that mutual understanding, to whatever degree we can achieve that in maybe half the time we have or a third of the time that we have, move on to our personal reactions or interpretations or to other forms of meaning making, which, you know, could be emergent. But that first we'd start just by, you know, making sure we understand the text, whatever we understand that to be. So with that said, I would invite you to John to get us started, and then we can move into the discussion. We've all, by the way, also already know each other. We've introduced ourselves, so we don't have to do that. Anybody who's watching this for the first time can go back to our previous discussions to learn more about ourselves and about us individually. So let's jump into it, shall we?
Go for it.
Okay. I think that the first point worth noting as a kind of footnote is that I don't think this chapter would exist without Deleuze and Guattari's chapter in A Thousand Plateaus on faciality. I think that this chapter is very much a conscious response to that chapter in A Thousand Plateaus, and even refers to them in this chapter, so we know that there's a concrete relationship. And the chapter on faciality, it's called Year Zero Faciality. Simply, it follows their chapter on what they call these different sign regimes. And a sign regime for Deleuze and Guattari is a system of signifiers. It's a fancy French POMO term for basically something that might be equivalent to Gebser's consciousness structures. The French translation of that is sign regimes. Each consciousness structure has its own its own sign regime. And there are three different kinds of faciality that they mention, and it's just worth having a little background here as we come into this chapter. Three different sign regimes. They've got four primary sign regimes, but three of them are associated with faciality, and the first is the pre-signifying sign regime. This corresponds more or less to Gebser's magical consciousness structure. It has to do with the tribal world. And in the tribal world, the faciality is hidden by the mask. The mask hides the face, and the mask substitutes as a signifier for the face. And that is the faciality that we find associated with the pre-signifying regime. The signifying regime proper is what they call the despotic regime, which comes in with the rise of the Bronze Age despot, great god ruler, in which the visage is represented as a god-king countenance with the light of the other world shining through that countenance. And it can cause paranoia. The despot is frequently paranoid. It's a sort of paranoid sign regime. That sign regime goes all the way down. You can trace it all the way down to Byzantine art, which has a bit of influence on this, on Sloterdijk's discussion as well. And then the third sign regime that has a faciality assigned to it is simply that of the what they call the Hebrew passional or post-signifying sign regime, which is based on a mode of betrayal. And so the face is turned into profile. It's turned away in a mode of betrayal that's goes all the way down to the psychoanalyst's couch with Freud, where you don't face the classic treatment is you're facing away from the patient. That sign regime goes all the way down to that, with that kind of faciality turned away from the god, as Moses must turn away from the apparition of the divine and not see it. Otherwise, he's blasted by the countenance of the radiance. So there's that as a kind of archaeology of the chapter. There's these ideas are worth thinking about as you read through the chapter, and as we begin the chapter and move into it. Sloterdijk starts by referring back to the discussion between Lysias and Phaedrus, where they see, they're beholding each other's countenance, And the countenance is one that is informed by the Platonic idea of the light from another world. The faciality is, in the Platonic sense, is connected to the ideality of the realm of the forms and the ideas, in an almost Neoplatonic sense, where the light from another world shines through the visage. And the beauty of the beautiful visage is meant to remind one of the soul, the soul's original experience of beautiful forms in the between life world, the world between lives. And so beauty experienced through the visage is a memory of that world. So Sloterdijk begins his sort of archaeological history of faciality confined primarily to Northwestern Europe with that, and then moves into a discussion of Giotto's, a couple of paintings from Giotto's Arena Chapel dating from about 1306, where he begins to talk about the relationship between, in one of the paintings, between Joachim and St. Anne. Joachim has been exiled from the city and he is returning to greet St. Anne, and these are the parents of Mary. And he points out that in the image you can see the two halos of Joachim and Anne merging together almost to form a single bubble. So Giotto gives us a good concrete image of a microsphere, an intimate dyadic biune microsphere that is achieved through faciality, or interfaciality as the term that Sloterdijk uses, in this image. And it's a beautiful image that forms where Joachim is kissing Anne and the two together form a third face. And you can see the third face looks almost like a Picasso face. If you look at it, he gives a close up to where you can see this third face emerging in a ghostly manner between them, giving a sense of the interlocking of an intimate biune interfacial microsphere. Then he contrasts this with another painting that is the opposite of this, which is Judas kissing Christ in the mode of betrayal, which is interesting because we remember the mode of betrayal is part of the Hebrew passional post-signifying sign regime in D&G. So that sign regime has survived along with the Byzantine despotic sign regime. There's a mixed regime here present in these images in a wonderful way. The West gradually has to shed this Byzantine influence. But we see the visages in this painting of the Judas kiss and the rupture of the microsphere. Christ is the pantocrator, the world, the sphere-forming world God-man who has the power to form intimate spheres, both macrospheric and microspheric. And here he is the God-man condescending to kiss Judas, who he already knows will betray him. And Judas is represented in a kind of the kind of animal-like physiognomy of acquisitiveness and greed, and he's outside the microsphere that what Christ would otherwise have formed with him or his disciples. And so we get this contrast. Then what Sloterdijk does is he moves on into a discussion of the evolution of faciality in Northwest European art, but he mentions this idea that Byzantine art has a very strong influence, and what I've called in my book Art After Metaphysics, the influence of Byzantine art on Western art, Northwestern European art, took a while to shake off. And its influence consisted in the creation of what I termed in that book iconotypes. I couldn't find a term for it elsewhere, so I simply termed them iconotypes. And iconotypes are repetitive, typical representations of the Last Supper, the ascension of Mary to heaven, the crucifixion, the beheading of John the Baptist. These are all iconotypes. And Byzantine art is made up exclusively of iconotypes. And so it's exclusively a kind of Neoplatonic art of the light of the other world shining down into this one. It emphasizes eternity, not temporality. So we have this iconotypical influence as Western art gets going, and Giotto is normally quoted as being this sort of first great Western painter. You can already see it disintegrating, though. The gold dome of the heavens in Byzantine art disintegrates to the blue sky of Giotto. He's the first to start painting the sky blue. And so you can already see it starting to disintegrate. The iconotypes are shed, and as they are shed, a new, what I actually simply say, a new iconotype comes into being, and that is the portrait study. The portrait study begins to come into being with the Renaissance, in which the individual is represented now as a singularity. The individual is represented as a rupture with the light from the other world that is no longer emphasized as an eternal light, plugging him into an eternal iconotype. The iconotype is shed, and the individual emerges, arises, opens, and emerges as a metaphysical manifestation unto himself or herself. The individual now is himself a metaphysical revelation of uniqueness, a revelation of a singularity that the portrait artist now captures as an evanescent image moving through temporality. So the emphasis begins to shift from the Neoplatonic realm, which inspired the Renaissance and got it going with Marsilio de Ficino and so forth, to the realm of the temporal, the mundane, the banal. Then we begin to get the expansion in Dutch art of the other iconotypes, and the primary iconotypes that replace the typical iconotypes of Mary and the crucifixion and so forth are the portrait study, the still life, and the landscape painting. Those are the three genres, or the three iconotypes, if you want to apply that term to this category, that now begin to emerge as revelations of a Western metaphysical universe that lights up. And it is thoroughly metaphysical. The art is deceptively realistic. It's not a realistic art at all. It's purely and thoroughly metaphysical. And it's filled with a revelation of the discovery of infinite space as the spheres, the macrospheres, collapse, and infinite space opens up, and the iconotypical microspheres collapse, and the individual emerges now in relationship to this new optical horizon of the subject's point of view gazing out into the infinite. And so there's an interrelationship now between the microsphere of the individual and the macrosphere of infinite space that now replaces the gold-closed cavern dome of the Byzantine world. And so Sloterdijk discusses this for a while and chews on it in his wonderful fashion. He's very good at chewing scenes, as we would say in acting, and eventually traces this down to the rise of modernist art, where he says that with modernist art, the portrait is done away with by the detrit. One other thing I forgot to mention that seeps into this is his concept of protraction. Now, protraction is something that has both a biological and a cultural basis. And he says that the biological basis of protraction is simply the sexual selection process that has resulted throughout the hominization process of selecting beautiful faces and wanting to sexually reproduce those faces. And so there's an aesthetic dimension to Homo sapiens sapiens that is missing with animals. There's an aesthetic drive that supplements the Darwinian fitness principle with an aesthetic principle, wanting to reproduce beautiful visages. And so there's a protraction, or an extraction of the human from the animal. In B&G's chapter, this would be called the process of deterritorialization, where they say that the face is a deterritorialized animal snout, just as the hand is a deterritorialized paw, and the tool that it holds is a deterritorialized branch. And so he's sort of adapting some of the terminology and ideas here from V&G as he moves then finally into a discussion of the rise of the detrit in modernist art. And the detrit replaces the portrait. So the protraction process now is no longer the relationship of the human to other humans. We're living in an age now slowly of the relationship of the human to the inhuman, what Thomas Pynchon calls wonderfully in his novel the inanimate, or the human. The relationship more and more of the human visage is to closed feedback loops with cameras and machines. And Sloterdijk mentions this as part of the basis for the rise of the detrit, where the facial codes are scrambled. And this, again, is Sloterdijk re-territorializing D&G's concept of defacialization from that chapter, where the facial codes are scrambled. They're scrambled, and this becomes especially evident in the art of Francis Bacon. And I think Bacon was the best at doing this, of taking a face and simply making a scrambled egg mess out of it so that it becomes a sort of meaningless sense of something that has been deterritorialized off the plane of significance into an a-signifying plane, where there is no meaning to the face and no codes can be ascribed to it. It becomes now a new kind of slate. It's as though Bacon were taking the face with an eraser on a chalkboard and wiping it clean, so that then new codes can then come along to be ascribed to a new form of faciality, which is perhaps still yet to emerge and is slowly emerging as the human canvas of the face is a blank slate upon which new codes will be inscribed. And so with that little synopsis, I'll turn it over to you guys.
Well, I would suggest we dig further into the chapter and maybe bring out some other elements, further details to the overview that you just provided, John. For example, one area that I'd be interested in exploring a bit is the role of the mother and the role of the mother-child relationship, or the mother-child primary or primordial faciality, and what value or importance that Sloterdijk gives to this relationship in the larger scheme of his, you know, spherology. It seems that part of what he's trying to do is to recover those primary experiences, or those primary spaces, and to, I would say, perhaps reintegrate them in our conception of, you know, who we are as, you know, as beings. Insofar as part of what he's trying to establish is that the face doesn't arise individual. It doesn't at first arise as an individual. It arises as a space of interfaciality, and in the first instance, one that is not a signifying or a semantic faciality, but one that he talks about as a radiance. So the mother and child beam at each other, and the attractiveness of each to the other is very important. And what seems to happen in the course of, you know, that primary sphere expanding or differentiating into multiple spheres is that there's a loss, perhaps, of a sense of, or an intimacy with that primary space, and that has all kinds of repercussions and implications in our lived experience. So I'd be interested in opening up, you know, that question or any others that arise within the arc that you've described, and I'd just open it up to anyone to chime in on that.
Well, I don't know where to begin. That this is really fascinating. I've been reading a lot on the CIA and psychic spying. And one of the things they do when they train CIA psychic spies, it's required reading. Betty Edwards' book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. And I think that's very curious. But it's very important that they know the difference between a received image and a constructed image. This is pretty crucial if you want to be a psychic spy. You want to know the difference between making up something and actually receiving a direct hit. And that's the way I find myself reading this book. It's I'm relying a lot on a kind of somatic intelligence that just receives certain images. And I also am aware that I'm constructing images as I go along. I know this is probably a little weird, but I had an experience once as I was shaving in the mirror. And, you know, if you guys shave in the mirror, it's sometimes a boring task. It is for me, at least. And I find my mind sort of drifting to other kinds of experiences. And one day I was looking at my face in the mirror, and as I shaved, I recalled I got a very strong feeling of Norton, who was a pit bull dog who lived in my neighborhood, who belonged to a very close friend of mine, whom I hadn't seen in a very long time. So I got this real direct hit of this feeling of Norton, this pit bull dog. And I hadn't seen my friend Ed in a long time, who owned the dog, or who was a companion of the dog. And then all of a sudden, walking down the street, I saw Ed, hadn't seen him in a long time. I said, "How's it going?" And he said, "Norton died. I had to put him down 2 days ago." This is the day that I was shaving my face and got this strong hit. And then I realized, I sort of put it all together, that, oh, that wasn't just a confused kind of something I was making up, but I was receiving something about this particular dog, this person who was in a strong relationship with this dog and who was in a strong relationship with me. And Ed said that, you know, Norton, his dog, had ascended to dog heaven or whatever. So I'm just playing with this because I believe these, for me, reading this particular chapter is like moving from one room of a gallery to another room in another gallery with this very intelligent tour guide who's just pointing out certain features of the paintings and sort of creating little stories and vignettes around them. And I think it's very important as we go from room to room in a gallery that we register the effects of the room we're leaving and the room that we're going into. Because it's in that in-between, those two different kinds of psychoactive spaces, that I think all kinds of intuitive hits occur. If we're sensitive to that transition from room to room, most of us are not. We're pretty mindless about that. So I'm just offering that because, to me, I remember Nabokov said when he reads with his spine. And I thought, what the fuck is he talking about, reading with his spine? But I think I start to understand he's talking about reading with his somatic intelligence. And it's that somatic intelligence combined with our cognitive that I believe can register the effects of the field in I think, unique and creative ways. So that's how I'm reading this book. And when I read it this way, I sort of enjoy it in a way that I wouldn't if I was just trying to cognitively figure out what is this guy, what is this guy up to? Because I think he writes in a, you're not going to find anything too systematic or logical arguments being offered. I think he's writing in a very deductive kind of way. He's really using a lot of analogy and story. And I find it fun. So that's where I'm at right now. Thank you.
I find it kind of interesting. He was talking about, I guess he references Deleuze and Guattari on the idea that, like Deleuze and Guattari say that faciality is a European phenomenon, that all faciality is the face of Christ. I think he disagrees with it. I forget exactly what. I'm trying to find exactly what he says about that. But I know he contrasts the face of Christ with the face of Buddha, and in terms of the suffering of Christ, and then the sort of serenity of the face of the Buddha, and the sort of the stance that each has towards suffering and. Let's see if I can dig it up here somewhere. This is unlike the face of Christ, which aims either for final suffering or for the representation of transcendence. Buddha's face shows the pure potential of an absolute imminent touchability by whatever comes before it. By floating in a state of readiness to resonate, this face is itself the realization of the gospel. It announces nothing. Rather showing what is already there. As an expressive manifestation of euphoric emptiness, the countenance of the awakened one in contemplation is the opposite of the character heads of Western Caesars, muddled by violence and marked by determination. Which I guess is reminds me of the other thing he's talked about the Roman Trinity of Caesar, Augustus, and the Roman Empire. I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but I find it's interesting way he curates these different modes of faciality within different cultures and what they express.
So I first want to thank John for that introduction. That was great, very much so. And the philosopher in me is very curious about Sloterdijk's use of history. So I'm not clear about exactly what form of genealogy he's enacting here. I think there's some form of genealogical analysis that brings us to the present. I think Marco was alluding to something of this. Let's just put that to the side. The art historian in me is fascinated by this analysis of late medieval and Renaissance art. And I would just add quickly that in the Renaissance, the emergence of individuals, I would speak of it in terms of Heidegger's notion of a subject, the self as a subject. And that word is first used in the 14th century in that sense. There are hybrids there too. The individuality is now not self-contained as it might start to appear more in the Dutch period and so on. And there are hybrids of these unique selves or singularities in the paintings. And this openness to receiving something from above And in these Renaissance paintings, the negotiation between this new, more individuated, singular human being and the sense of a unique interiority in part is combined with an older sense of inward and upward towards God in a receptive mode. And you get these fantastic hybrids. And just if anyone's interested, I wrote a paper many years ago out of my dissertation on how this operates in Raphael and the emergence of artists as a special kind of creator. And it's a very distinctive form of self-portraiture that links to these kinds of themes, which are fundamentally metaphysical. So I'm fascinated by this whole genealogy. And my question would be, what's the purpose of this? What is the health and unhealth, if that is the value scheme of writing this? What needs to be, what's our thrownness? What's the significance of our thrownness? And as this genealogy discloses faciality and other aspects, what needs to be championed, strengthened, and what needs to be discarded and recovered?
When I saw him talking about the sort of shift from the sort of Platonic Byzantine mode of art to the sort of Western mode of art, which depicts scenes that are unfolding in time, I was actually reminded a little bit of Gebser. For Gebser, it's still a very sort of linear. It's still not what Gebser would sort of call the sort of eruption of time consciousness or the integral mode of consciousness. But it is an interesting mode from the sort of as John said, from the eternal to the temporal, which I think speaks of a kind of imminence of divinity and a sort of panentheism in artwork, which is interesting. Reminds me of a thing, change that happened in the Catholic Church with Vatican II, because prior to Vatican II, when the priest is blessing the Eucharist, he would face away from the congregation toward the altar. But Vatican II introduced a change where you would face toward the congregation and break the bread, which to me emphasizes a kind of panentheism where God is in the congregation and he's acknowledging God in the church, which I think is another interesting sort of interfaciality to contemplate.
I'm drawn to jump in here and comment to say that I was kind of drawn to different things in the chapter, and in keeping with Marco's original suggestion to kind of focus at first on sort of trying to just parse out what I understood from the chapter. I'm drawn to a passage that I'm going to quickly read that to me was at the heart of what I got from it. And this is on page 200, where Sloterdijk is talking about basically making the point, to paraphrase what John Ebert said earlier, that I don't know if it was John, but that the initial interfacial encounter is the sort of primary source of things. And the passage says, in the initial bipolar interfacial game, the gazes are distributed among the partners in such a way that each, for the time being, learns enough about himself by looking into the face of the other who is looking at him. The other thus acts as a personal mirror, but he is also the opposite of a mirror, for he permits neither the peace nor the discretion of a reflection in glass or metal, but above all, because he produces not only an eidetic reproduction, but rather an effective echo. And I just found that really important. And the thing that this whole chapter, you know, spoke to me was the dialogic philosophers, Levinas and Martin Buber. And I know Sloterdijk mentions Levinas in passing, but to me there was the real, you know, the insight that I think Levinas and Buber brought, also in my understanding, especially Levinas, in direct response to Heidegger, is that experience of interfaciality is maybe a subset of, or a different way of getting at, you know, the encounter with the other, with the capital O, is the primary source of identity, certainly, and the primary source of sort of the thrust to being in the world. And I could be wrong here because I'm not an expert on these guys, but my understanding is that we can read this idea of the encounter with the other as a sort of totalizing pull into being, sort of interpolation or being pulled into being by virtue of that responsiveness to the other. And I certainly saw a lot of stuff in this chapter that pulled me into that. And I guess my understanding of what Sloterdijk was going for here is, I think, aligned with that sort of perspective that we are first and foremost sort of pulled into being with the other, but in a way that destabilizes us, which I think is another insight of the dialogic philosophers and of that passage I read, where in truly looking into the other as a mirror or a mirror and opposite of mirror, it's a destabilizing as well as stabilizing move kind of at the same time, because unlike looking in a glass or metal mirror, the other does not reflect us in the sense that it both completes us and leaves the space open, leaves the incomplete or creates the incompleteness that pulls us forward. Which again, I could go into a whole bunch of stuff. I think that's the pattern of communicative meaning making at a broader level. That's, I think, really important. And this is important to note here is that, you know, one way to think about what communication is and what the intersubjective or the communicative process is between people, interpersonal, is that we are by speaking, by having this back and forth exchange, we're actually creating both the completeness and the incompleteness that drives us to make the next move or to feel the incompleteness that we're compelled to fill with our attempts to move forward. And anyway, I guess I feel like maybe I'm diverging a bit from the chapter or getting more into my own interpretation here, but that was what really stood out to me. I think the art history stuff is interesting, but I found myself really frustrated the first third of the chapter or whatever, which to me felt purely like, you know, sort of literary criticism or artistic kind of interpretation. And it was only in the second part of the chapter where he started really talking about these different modes of interfacial stuff and sort of the dynamics at play that I really got hooked in. But anyway, I think I was surprised that there wasn't more of a connection made to these notions of dialogic kind of, you know, engagement. And I think that maybe has more to do with Sloterdijk's mode of exploring things through art and through kind of literature than, and not being as literal or not being as direct with his perspective. But anyway, I guess that's, I'll stop there.
Can I chime in or does someone else want to speak right now? Can I just respond? Okay. Earlier in the conversation, John was talking about Joachim and Anne, that painting, the Giotto, and there was a kiss. And he says, if you can notice that there's the visible and the invisible third face. If you look at the painting in a certain way. And later, I think we mentioned the coin of Octavian, and you see the two faces of the file of the father and the son. And he mentions in the text that money is the third person in this Holy Trinity, on this the coin of Octavian. I'm very curious about this third phase. And later on in the text on page 202, I just will quote this briefly. He's talking about individualism, the nascent individual. At this point, there's a living observer, inner witness of their own lives, one could say, that, and they adopt the perspective of an outside view on themselves and thus augment their interfacial spheric opening with a second pair of eyes that, strangely enough, is not even their own. I think that's really fascinating. I think that when it's not their own, that second pair of eyes, the visible, invisible, that third face, I think that happens to us a lot. I just, a personal anecdote, and this was very destabilizing for me. I got into an elevator, and I was dressed in a tuxedo for a party, and I was looking, you know, really good. And I got into the elevator with the actress Ellen Burstyn. whom I greatly admired. And she looked at me, and I could tell there was a look in her eye of great interest in me, and it shocked me. Because I was always gazing at her on the big screen, I was very familiar with her face and all the roles that she had played. But it was a stunning experience for me to see that she was gazing at me, and we were alone in an elevator. Later, 10 years later, I saw her again on the street, and she approached me because she was parking her car, and she was looking for coins, and she didn't know how to put them in the meter or how many coins she needed to put in the meter. And she asked me, do you know how much money I need to put in the meter? And I recalled that I had seen her like 10 years previously in this elevator. And I don't know if she was aware of that previous connection or not, but I am aware of how faces that change over time, we get to know actors and actresses as they age on the big screen. We see we remember their voices and their faces from previous performances, maybe decades before when they were young and now they're elderly. I think those kinds of transformations are very fascinating because I think it plays on that visible and invisible, that third phase, that looking at ourselves from the outside of ourselves. I think that kind of thing can lead to destabilization and dissociation, which I think is pretty epidemic in our culture right now. So anyway, I'm just throwing that out there because I think the interplay of the senses, the visual, the kinesthetic, the auditory, once these are stabilized, they can be destabilized by certain kinds of cultural forces that I think we're all pretty familiar with. And I'm just wondering about what happens next, because we're looking, even as we are having this conversation using Zoom, we see a certain version of each other's faces in different rooms and different places around the globe. And I'm just wondering what this is doing to our nervous system. And I think,
you know, I this is self-serving, and it has nothing to do with the text, but I wrote an entire book about this. It's interesting that John mentions this because this is my book, Dead Celebrities, Living Icons, is precisely about that and makes just exactly the point that John just made about the celebrity's relationship with the various media apparatus has a destabilizing and decentering effect. Very often, not always, but more often, I think, than not, has a destabilizing effect on the celebrity's personality and can send them spiraling into psychological forms of chaos. And I think this is a phenomenon that, you know, the self-destructive celebrity whose faciality forms a kind of feedback loop through electronic repetition of the image. And, of course, Andy Warhol was the first artist, I think, to capture this feedback resonance effect of faciality through electronic media poured back into the celebrity psyche in his art. I think he was the first with his sort of obsessive compulsive repetitive images of Liz Taylor and so forth to really capture that. But it had already been happening before he caught it in the New York art world in the 50s with phenomena such as Elvis Presley and James Dean and Marilyn Monroe, famous individuals whose psyches were destabilized. My thesis anyway, in Dead Celebrities, Living Icons, were destabilized by their interaction with initially the big screen with Elvis, it was television, as well as the film. And with Marilyn Monroe, it was purely a filmic and photographic process of destabilization with the double selves, Norma Jean Baker and Marilyn Monroe and so forth. And these destabilizations that take place in the psyche have gradually been democratized to the rest of us through the proliferation of media such as YouTube and Facebook, of course, and our iPhones. And each individual now has their own sort of personal celebrity cult of me now. And so it's been democratized through these kinds of media. And so now we can all experience the kind of destabilizing effects that these media can inflict upon. I just wanted to throw that out there. I mentioned it, and I couldn't resist. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's great, Don. I have to read your book. I think the destabilizing effect on the movie star is also being produced by the projections from strangers, people they've never met and never will meet, but that get stuck, I hate to sound new agey, in their aura. You know, so they are probably need to find a way of clearing themselves so that they can function as an ordinary person And I think there are many actors and actresses who successfully do that. But it's the ones who are extremely vulnerable to other people's projections who crash and burn.
Right. Yeah.
But aren't we all forced to be actors and actresses now?
And I think we're all crashing and burning to some extent.
I mean, isn't that kind of the precipitating fact of our lives? I mean, even of this meeting, in a certain way, for me, doing this reading group is a flight from a state of destabilization, which I was particularly experiencing acutely through my interactions on Facebook. You know, the semantic interfacial space of our age. And it's so interesting and ironic that here we are, I'm looking at a grid of faces. You're seeing my face. We're recording this. So a public will see our face. We're performing a conversation. There's a performative aspect to our speaking about this subject. It's staged. We're enacting it. So we're kind of caught up in the very themes that Slodrick is discussing in this chapter, but which we don't, I think, typically reflect. I certainly haven't thematically reflected upon in the way that the impressions that I'm receiving from not just the book, but our experience here right now are awakening in me, or causing in me.
I was reminded of Rupert Sheldrake's experiments on the sense of being stared at. You know, in the sense that people can someone can look at you from behind you, and you can tell they're being stared at. So I think the idea that our senses are not merely passive but projective, and that and that our sense of being perceived is actually a big part of who we are. I'm also reminded of René Girard and his theory about the sacrificial victim and mimetic desire, because his idea is that the sacrificial, that societies that didn't before societies with legal structures, in order to maintain peace, they had to have a single person upon whom they would project all their their unsatisfied desires and anger, and this person would be set apart from society, not merely in a negative way. Often this sort of sacrificial victim would be given this praiseworthy role and seen as sort of hoisted on people's shoulders right up until the point that when they're killed. And he talks about even monarchies actually can act as sort of what the monarch can act as a sacrificial victim, set apart from society, encouraged to engage in taboos that are forbidden to others, like such as incest, so that they can be sort of, they can absorb these sort of aspects of ourselves that we don't want. And I feel like even celebrity culture kind of perpetuates that, where people, on the one hand, they become our gods, but they're the sacrifice gods that
Yeah, has anyone seen the movie The Stoning of Soraya M? That's is like a concrete visual representation of exactly Girard's theory of what he was talking about, where apparently in a village in Iran, in 1979, this woman was stoned to death. They were still stoning people to death. And this woman had supposedly had an adulterous affair, but not really. But the villagers perceived her as having this affair. And so they all got together, including her family and her children. This is a true story. Her family and her children, and they stoned her to death. And it's really shocking and horrific. But it brings home, in a visceral sense, that Girard's theory of the sacrifice of the one who is set apart as the scapegoat, and all the anger and angst and projections that are animating the village or upsetting them get projected like a black hole into this one figure, who then takes those down with her into the abyss and cleanses the psyche of the village so that it can function normally again. It's a horrific idea, but to what degree it works, I don't know. I mean, it's horrible to think about, but
I don't think it does work.
Old practice. Well, what proof do we have that it does or it doesn't, is what I wonder.
Well, look at our world today.
it survived so long, one has to wonder if there was some cleansing aspect to it.
Right.
But then allowed, you know, and now we have our celebrities to do this too, like Jonathan was saying, now we have our celebrities stones out. So go ahead.
Yeah, that's true. Let me just throw in here, in the because the word scapegoat came up, in that ancient Hebrew goat herding culture, they projected it all onto a goat that they sent out. They didn't have to stone the person. They didn't have to kill a human being. They did this in another way. And so there are alternative means of taking care of that. They're also horrific, I suppose, and it's because we have to deal with things that are very deep and unsettling within us, but there are ways and means of doing that.
Right. And for Gerard himself, who's a Catholic, you know, he sees Christ as a sort of turning point in that, where he proves not overturns the regime of the sacrificial victim by being the innocent sacrificial victim, who proves not only his own innocence but the innocence of the sacrificial victim writ large, and therefore he sees the role of Christianity as sort of undoing the sacrificial consciousness within humanity.
It sort of did it as a transcendental signified mm-hmm. for the culture as a whole by uplifting the image of a single sacrifice, mm-hmm. a monumental event in Hegel's term, the right. axial event of history, around which everything pivots, as a single sacrificial victim that's then mm-hmm. Put onto the cross and uplifted, and it becomes the primary transcendental signified for the West. It almost acts as a magnet that performs that function that was being performed by the villagers in the stoning of Sarai M for the culture as a civilization, as a macro scale civilizational entity, for them to then project all their angst and so forth onto this one being who was sacrificed and willingly sacrificed, as the theology goes, and to become this sort of magnet for all these collective projections that then gather around this sacrificed being. And so one wonders then, to what degree does the collapse of this transcendental signified, the disintegration of the transcendental signified or the iconic status of the crucifix, then loses that function, that organizing function for the entire society, and then we start getting the proliferation of all these weird sacrificial phenomena, such as what we've been talking about with celebrities and mass violence and the increase of rage and shootings and so forth. One wonders about that, to what degree that image held the society together as a kind of hinge that pulled everything and integrated it successfully, and the dismantling of it being not a good thing for the society. I wonder about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're all... I'm sorry. Wendy, were you going to speak?
Okay.
I was going to hear another voice. I was just responding because I think looking at our media and how we're using it in Facebook and how we're somatizing disturbances in our society, where we're confronted by so many faces in our social media. And I think some of us are, like I just used that example of responding, and somewhere my mind was aware of this, my friend and his dog, and him putting down this dog. Now, I didn't have a scenario or a story or a narrative, but I just got this strong emotional flash. And I have a funny feeling, this is happening to us all the time, to various degrees we're aware of it, but I think now that we're sort of being invaded by so many faces every day and through our social media with so many stories, and none of it is integrated. Most of the stories we get are, you know, temporary attempts to make something coherent, but we see so many of them that at the end of the day, if we're using social media a lot, I think there's a lot of a lot of more destabilization than there is camaraderie or intimacy. So I hope this, what we're doing today, is sort of an antidote to that kind of frantic absorbing stuff that probably doesn't even belong to us, but we still take it home with us. So I'm just sharing that with you because I think this is sort of like what Sheldrake was talking about, that morphogenetic field. We may be tuning into very intrusive energies, and if we don't know how to clear ourselves, we may be creating a great deal of havoc. And I think that's why we're all, to some extent, getting scapegoated. So I don't know that that strategy is going to work anymore, because we can't pick a person, dump all of our projections onto them, and string them up. It just isn't going to stabilize or unify us anymore. Anyway.
If I could jump in, I'd like to... Okay, I guess I'm going to run with it. I just want to jump in and kind of extend this by saying that I think, part of... I think Michael originally was the one who kind of raised the perspective that we could be looking for something prescriptive, or at least, you know, some guidance toward how to be, or how to respond to this reality that I think everyone has been talking about really, really eloquently, which is that sort of the destabilization, the scapegoating, and the democratization, as John Ebert put it, of this sort of celebrity breaking apart of self, or destabilizing of identity. I guess I have a sense that there's, so directly in response to that, I have other thoughts, but I'll table those for the moment. But directly in response to this question of how to be, I found that Sloterdijk's description of the Buddha is really important here, which is to say that, we're talking here about, and rightly so, but we're talking about all the things that are wrong with our society now, and, you know, how one argument is that, you know, this, the lack of scapegoating, or the lack of having someone we can project everything onto and then string up there, is sort of a destabilizing factor, or that the argument being, and this comes up in other places, you know, that the purge is the thing that keeps society integrated, the ability to purge or to otherwise, you know, push into a safe vessel, or at least a constrained vessel, all of our bad things. And, you know, and I was really, it's interesting to hear the insight about Christianity shifting that dynamic. Although I think, you know, my initial thought was, oh, that's exactly what the Christ figure is someone who is the ultimate vessel for all of our bad stuff, who just kind of takes it and cleanses us by taking it all on. But I think that to get back to the Buddha, I think that the important thing there is in that passage, where we talk about the Buddha being constantly present and ready for whatever comes, without any judgment, without any agenda, but just sort of present and aware. And it's sort of, to me, that's an important figure, because it's maybe not an antidote, but it's a different way. If you think of the Buddha as being someone who could be and would be targeted and projected upon and given all of the pain and all of the bad stuff, what's amazing about the Buddha figure is that they're not a passive vessel. They're actually, in a sense, what I'm trying to get at, and I'm having a hard time getting there, is that presence and that ability to be genuinely responsive, without judgment, without your own projection kind of coming into play, to me, that's another way to break the cycle. In other words, if that's the state of the Buddha, and you come up to the Buddha projecting your bullshit onto the Buddha, as it were, just to use this as kind of a thought experiment, you're not going to get the sort of sacrificial victim. You're not going to be able to overcome, in a sense, the will or the being of the Buddha by projecting your bullshit onto them and making them what you want them to be. Right. And that's, I'm not really finding a good way to put it, but I think that's really important, because that figure to me represents the sort of strength to break that cycle without it being a force of will, right? Because that's the whole point, is the Buddha's just sitting there smiling at you, and you feel like a dumbass because you're projecting your shit onto the Buddha, not because the Buddha makes you feel like a dumbass. Do you see what I'm saying? So it is a sort of a type of mirror that I think can break that cycle. Anyway, I don't know if I fully have that thought through, but I think that's really important.
I'd like to echo Nate, yeah, and bring it back to Girard in the same moment. My understanding of Girard is that human socialization necessarily involves both a kind of enabling. I imitate the actions of the other in relation to some object of desire in the world, and simultaneously sets up an unconscious rivalry. That object might be scarce, or is experienced by the infant as scarce, and hence is a threat to the other's desire, which allows me access to the apple, is also the very desire that will take the apple away. And this socialization process sets up a kind of knot, an individuation, he calls it, in which culture is unstable, because it both has these collective common conventions of practice, and it has these desires, these socialized desires, which are always in conflict and have an unconscious aggression to them. And so what historically emerged were a whole series of explicit, and then in modernity, with things like law, sort of sublimated versions of sacrifice in some sense. And scapegoating, sacrifice, scandal discourse, which is all over the place in our culture, seem to be very much alive. In my understanding of Girard's understanding of the crucifixion is that it's been partly misread in Christianity. The tradition misread it. That actually Christ was trying to show the absurdity of the sacrificial mechanism. He was trying to sort of parody it in some way. I'm not sure that's a convincing argument. And that the only solution that I've come across in Girard is actually a higher form of mimesis. And that form is to take up love of the neighbor. That it's imitating Christ. It's an imitation of Christ. It's emptying oneself to such a degree that love becomes the mimetic model in relationship to others that can slowly dissolve this aggression of the human being in relation to others. And I would kind of echo the sense of the Buddha, where this radiating of joy as a transmission has no agenda, right? It has no agenda, and it could diffuse these kinds of projections and so on. So, but I also find John, your discussion of the transcendental signified of and that falling apart and the decentering and fragmenting, and everyone's now a victim and everyone is sacrificed, and Montana representatives are body slamming guardian people is everywhere, is a kind of like something is unhinged, and with these sacrificial victim mentality mechanisms.
Well, it's not unifying them anymore. That's what's the problem. They're looking for scapegoats, and the only thing that unifies them is a scapegoat. And if they don't have one, they're in big trouble.
They start falling apart.
They start beating their kids and beating up their wife and getting drunk and creating mayhem. So they need to find an enemy. And I think that's a really big problem.
And the question is, what's the way out? I agree with you. And what's the way out of that? I mean, for Girard, right or wrong, this is a very deep process in human being in this more or less quote unquote fallen world. So how do you move out of that?
I think that's we talk about Buddha and Christ and these beautiful images from Western art. I just wanted to bring up recently a film that won best movie this last year was Moonlight. And I saw the film many times. I think I saw it about four times. And I took friends to see it. It was a real communal kind of cathartic experience for me. And I listened to the director of the film, Barry Jenkins, making a decision like on the set. You saw these two characters having a dialogue with one another. And he asked one of the, I think it was an actress, to turn and look directly into the camera. So the audience looked right into her eyes. And he did this with all the major characters. He had them look into the camera, so the audience looked right into their eyes. And he did this in an intuitive but a very intentional way, because something happens to people in the audience as they all of a sudden are inside that person. They lose their sense of, I'm over here, the image is over there. All of a sudden, they're starting to embody or enter into that character's world in a very visceral way. So I thought that film is an excellent example of what can happen when you have a very good ensemble, a very good script, and you have a very smart director. And I straight people, I saw like, you know, really hardcore straight guys say they saw that movie. It's a gay love story. And they said, you know, it made them cry. So I think that is where the hope is. It's when we can all of a sudden can't separate ourselves easily from the dilemmas and the paradoxes another person has. So I think in this particular character, the character of Chiron in this particular movie, he was scapegoated, but he says he survives that. And I think he reclaims his dignity. And I think the audience benefits enormously. And I think that's how our culture can start shifting. We don't see many movies like that, but it's my hope that we would have more artists like that working at that level.
I think, if you look at like shifting attitudes towards things like homosexuality, towards people of other races, it's often through friendships and acquaintance that people overcome their prejudices. You know, a person of my generation is much more likely than the parents' generation to know a person who is gay or trans or is an immigrant or something like that, and that tends to breed more progressive attitudes toward which at the same time, we're in a big sacrificial crisis right now with Donald Trump and the rise of these far right parties across Europe, as this anti-immigrant, anti-multiculturalism ethos becomes rampant, and people are seeking a scapegoat for this economic mess that we've found ourselves in as a result of globalization. So I was saying finding that solution is like more urgent than ever, I think.
So what's Solidaridad's prescription here? One thing that I keep coming back to is the mother principle, is that primary dyad, and the wholesomeness of it, the healthiness of it, at least in its some ideal form. I think obviously in reality it's not always wholesome. It's broken. And insofar as that primary relationship with the mother is part of a wider network of relationships which themselves are frayed and broken, that experience doesn't get to happen in a healthy way a lot of the times. And it seems that one of the things that he's saying, or at least implying in this book, or at least one of the discourses that the book connects to, is that kind of notion of a primary trauma, which occurs because we become alienated from our own relationality, our own primary relationality, like that field that is prior to the semiological, distinctions that we make. That is really just the magical domain or dimension in Gebser's terminology. It's a childlikeness, because as the baby is, like if we insofar as we carry within us the residue or the trace or the real felt reality of that primary experience, and we become traumatized at that level, then that's going to act. We're going to act that out on every other level, in every other sphere. And so how do you restore that? How do you reintegrate that? There's an element, I think, of regression, if you were to look at it from the perspective of like developmental psychology, that Solidaridad seems to be indicating with this text. And we've gone now from the heart space to the face space. The heart space originally is the child inside of the mother's body, right? Feel the heartbeat so close that it's within you. The other's heart is within you, and now to the differentiation that happens with the face when there's two faces, but those two faces and the multi faces of of a society are at first not differentiated. It's the radiance of the mother gazing at the innocence, the vulnerability, the openness of the child. I know as a father how the samadhi that I felt when I first held my daughter when she was a newborn. There was that what Solidaridad calls in his text the melting point, the greenhouse effect, or the intersubjective greenhouse effect. I don't recall his exact words. He expressed it in a few different ways, but that sort of melting point that happens when our semantic or semiological distinctions break down and we just feel a communion with the other. And in that first instance, it's the mother. I think, that's not coming from an abstract plane. That's not a platonic form. That's a bio spiritual experience, right? It, it's something that's really specific to our form as humans. And it'd be interesting to, you know, we talked a bit about last week about posthumanism, and maybe that connects here as well, but there's something I think profoundly human in the sense, in the idea that that primary experience of being a mammal, a baby mammal, more than a mammal, but a person, like an incipient person in a pre-semantic relationship with a loving other who just beams at you and makes you feel good and makes you feel nourished, makes you feel whole. Coming out of that state of, you know, being born, being thrown, and being incompleted through the act of birth, being birthed. One of the things I think that art does really well, if it's good art, is that it integrates that magical, emotional, and bio-spiritual level. It integrates that experience across the different structures of consciousness, in Gabe's, you know, terms. So, and it brings it into development. It brings it into a cultural sphere that could be shared more broadly. And that I think is the power of a movie like Moonlight, as you describe it, John. And I have similar experiences, really profound. I mean, they're to me some of the most profound experiences of my life when I really commune with a work of art, and another person, in a sense, shows me my own original face, if you will, through the enactment of their creative vision. The distinction breaks between me and other breaks down. It doesn't break down into a regression. It breaks down into like a greater openness, a greater enlightenment. And so I also appreciate how Sloterdijk brings the Buddha figure and that sort, that model of equanimous presence as kind of a way of perhaps reintegrating the receptive, maternal, and feminine principle with an equanimity that comes through the disciplined practice, as you know, the Buddhist path would invite one to. And so, again, I don't know exactly where that lands, but other than that, that in some sense, I think what I'm getting from Sloterdijk is that philosophy should be fun, and there should be an enjoyable aspect to it. Like, we should enjoy the thought that we're embodying in this kinds of conversations, and that, even though it's a sort of marginal activity, and I was reading an excerpt from Sloterdijk's, remind me of the title, but it's Thoughts on the Human Zoo, something like that, John?
Rules for the Human Park, yeah.
Rules for the Human Park, or the, I mean, another translation is the Human Zoo.
Yeah, or Zoo, there's two different translations. Rules for the Human Zoo,
There's an interesting, there's some interesting things to think about there, because who wants to think of themselves as a zoo animal? But what he is saying there is that there's a civilizing or taming function that is important, you know, as part of our ability to live together on a planet in a social sphere, and that has not been accomplished. Obviously, to date, and you know, Heidegger argues that humanism has not accomplished that, and so, you know, being, it has to be accomplishment of being. Sloterdijk is also in a conversation with, you know, with Heidegger and with humanism, I think, in these pages. But I guess I'm getting into the mushy doughy space.
Well,
I'd like to speak to one piece, okay, and. I really appreciate what you're saying, Marco, about the mother bond and development, and the most synthetic work that's from a philosopher, but is drawing upon various psychological models that might address this, is Michael Washburn in his book Embodied Spirituality in a Sacred World. And he really does equate this, the differentiating of a separate self as a movement away from both the mother and the dynamic ground, he calls it. And he yet honors development. He is an anti-development, which some of these models have. And yet there's a need for certain dimensions to go back into all of that to reunify to the dynamic ground. And he calls this regression in the service of transcendence. And he's got a very careful map of this. So there's both sort of Wilberian-like development and something else going on about down. And these are simultaneous and needed for a kind of fullness of awakening, a fullness of relationship and awakening. And it is centered in the mother, and it is centered in recovering that. So I thought that was I agree with what you're saying.
Can I add something to that also? You're talking about the heart and the face. And I think the face and the heart are very connected. And I believe that we can look at other people in such a way as to register something quite invisible. I know, and talking about the human and the non-human and the post-human, that thing has been coming up. A friend of mine who lived in the neighborhood, she told me a story. She was raised by Polish immigrants, and her father and her mother were from the old country, and she was learning English, and I think she was having trouble with her arithmetic. And I think she was, she said she was like 8 or 9 years old. And her father was like tutoring her. And she had a bird that she kept in a cage. But the door of the cage bird, the door was open so the bird could come and go as it wanted to. Anyway, the father was tutoring the daughter and she was having trouble. The father got really frustrated and angry and he ended up hitting her in his frustration and anger. And the bird flew out of the cage and started to peck him. And the father was so shocked by this bird's intervention that he sat down and he got very quiet and he never hit her again. And I think that's a very remarkable story that sometimes this is the most highly ethical and altruistic aspects of our nature are sometimes carried by some animal. You know, you hear these rescue stories, you hear about these lost animal stories, how they an animal who is lost on the other side of the thousands of miles away can somehow find its family. I think there's, you know, something going on there that's very mysterious. And I'm hoping, and I do believe this connects to what we've been talking about and the text that we're studying. Because I do think there are a lot of overlaps. And I think he is moving from a kind of humanist to perhaps a post-humanist kind of development. Anyway, I just wanted to put that out there because we've been talking about this online.
I'll just mention that at the coffee shop down the street from me, you know how the coffee shops will rotate different artwork on the walls? Well, currently, there's the work of a local photographer who takes portraits of rescue animals. So these are all dogs and cats who are, you know, looking for foster guardians or parents or whatever. And it's all pictures of their face. But there is that protraction doesn't, I think, make interfaciality exclusive to the human. I have a dog. I used to have two. And I love her face. And she looks at me, and when she wants my attention, she stares at me and exercises some form of mental control because I get up and I feed her or I let her out and I do what she wills, and I feel her staring into me. I feel her boring into my mind. It's really uncanny, actually. And I've studied it. I've studied the phenomenology of what I'm experiencing when she does this. And it's a profound psychic connectivity that's there, and she has a face. It's not just human, and at the same time, of course, the you know, as fellow humans, it's particularly animated for us because our faces can do a lot more things than a dog's can do. So the range of our emotional connection
or emotional connectivity, as I think you're saying, the connection between face and heart really comes to all those comes down to all those hundreds of muscles, you know, coordinating to create these loops between us when we see each other. And of course, that's what's so difficult about the interface. And what happened to me earlier, as soon as I started talking about interfaces, my interface broke down, completely, just totally froze up. Maybe that was a message from being. It's very interesting to reflect on what, you know, what's actually been going on in our real experience of each other and of, you know, the mirror of relationship. It's quite fascinating.
If I may, Marco, I wanted to respond to something you raised a little bit earlier when you were talking about, so how do we resolve this, this kind of chaos that's going on in our society? What would be the new kinds of faciality that would come up that would, of course, faciality, I think, is always reflective already of processes that are already going on in the society. But I think that, and you raised Sloterdijk's essay, Rules for the Human Zoo, it's worth commenting that in that essay, he makes a distinction between media that are traditionally inhibiting and media that have a detrimental or disinhibiting function on the culture. And he says that, for instance, the book, which is a missive written by one and is the basis of humanism, which is sent out. It's a sort of letter written by someone that is sent out to an unknown reader, whoever that's going to be. But it has an inhibitory effect. It has a civilizing function, a domesticating function. With the Romans and the gladiatorial arenas, we have a classic example of what he calls disinhibiting media, where those media in that time were breaking down. They weren't working. The society was becoming illiterate, disliterate, non-literate, and so forth. And the rise of the gladiatorial arenas put the theater out of business, because why go see people faking death on stage when you can go see it for real? People chose the real thing, and it had a negative violent feedback effect on the society as a whole. And I think that part of the problem with the situation that we're in right now is that it is the job of the arts, art, myth, religion, and culture to resolve these problems for us, to provide new iconotypes, new signifieds that will replace the disintegration of the master signifiers that have ruled the West for 2,000 or so years, maybe more if you want to go back to Plato and Greeks and so forth. Those are iconotypes are being disintegrated. The problem is, when we turn to highbrow art, what we're left with is a very poor example in contemporary art, because with contemporary art right now, the basis of the art is aniconic. It's deconstructive. It's based on a mistrust ever since Malevich's black square and his white. It's based on a deconstruction of the image and a mistrusting of all traditional iconotypes as essentially binding, colonializing, produced by white men to subjectify the rest of us. And there's no trust in these meta-narratives anymore. And so contemporary art thinks its task is simply to take the images and keep pulling them apart. And so that's what it's doing. So it's not providing us with any kind of inhibitory, integrating, sphere-forming functions. Everything is broken down into these foamic little tiny microspheres. And contemporary art, I think, has invalidated itself for the task. Okay, so what are we left with? We're left with popular culture. Popular culture provides us with, through film and bestsellers and graphic novels, provides us with all these images. But the problem there is that would serve normally what the function of traditional art was to serve, which was a binding, inhibitory function. But popular art provides us with all of these disinhibiting images. What we see are images of sex and violence, people solving their problems through resorting to violence. Almost invariably, that's what any narrative is going to tell us with these popular narratives of superheroes and so forth. That the way to resolve your problems is by resorting to violence. And humans, being mimetic animals, tend to imitate the images that they see proliferating around them. So whatever's proliferating around them is what they're going to imitate. And because popular culture is providing us with all these images, this is what people imitate. And so it feeds back in a negative way into the society and continues further pulling it apart. Yes, we have these iconic images in our head of Bruce Lee, and, whatever the your favorite movie star is. But they are pulling the culture apart, both from a popular level and at the level of the highbrow arts. And so the arts are in a situation where that's where the response is supposed to normally come from, to integrate the culture by providing new forms of master signifiers, new forms of faciality, and so forth. But now we're getting, from technology, we're getting these new bizarre forms of faciality, like this one, for instance, or Facebook, where people are reduced to the level of two-dimensional electronic trading cards on Facebook. And so it's not a very satisfying response to the problem that we're faced with. And so we're really in a kind of a mess here with this civilization. It's a massive world acumeny that is based on violence as a problem-solving method that is full of images. And terrorists have taken over the media apparatus, and they have, Boris Groys writes about this in one of his essays, that the terrorist has taken over the apparatus of the media with YouTube and the video camera and so forth. And they are the ones who have provided a lot of these unsettling, iconic images that are imprinted on the mass psyche. No one's ever going to forget the images of the falling of the trade towers during 9/11, for instance, that normally would have been provided by art, but art is failing to do this. Nobody much cares about it insofar as it has a sphere-forming function that imprints and creates icons on the society. So we're really in an unsettled mode here where all the traditional roles are shifting around and everything is being transformed into what Zygmunt Bauman calls liquid modernity. All the archetypes are in a process of magmatic liquefaction. So we're in a transitional phase here, and we're all struggling. And I think what we're doing here today is a response. It's a form of struggling with the crisis that we're in right now. So I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Yeah. I'd like to jump in briefly in response to what you just said, John, and then to articulate what I've come to see as a common theme, a common thread in some of the recent some of the stuff we've been talking about, which is also a bit of a taking in a different direction. Just in direct response to what John said, I think that the one thing that was implied in that, or that I'd like to clarify coming out of that is that while I completely agree that our current technologies are a source of this distortion or a source of this further alienation, I resist any kind of technological determinism that says it is technology itself that is having this effect. I think Zoom and Facebook and any other technology that we want to look at is creating a sort of a weird effect. I think I completely agree, but I think that has to do with choices made in the development of that technology in the same kind of a...
That's naive. No, technology is not something that is value neutral. Every technology imposes upon us, and I know I'm being rude here. I'm sorry for that.
You are being rude, John.
I'm sorry, but technology an entelechy that is has a very deterministic function. I mean, this is the whole media studies tradition.
Let me be clear that I'm fully aware of that. Just to be clear, like I'm not making the claim that technology is value neutral in any sense. That's something that I'm pretty deeply. I feel the same way. I pretty deeply believe in that. What I'm trying to say is that I think that the values that are encoded and the assumptions that are encoded in the technologies that we use, which are in no way value neutral, are one among any number of different values that we can encode in a set of technologies. And now that's not to say that it's simple and that there's not path determinism. And I guess I'm starting to sense that maybe this isn't really what I wanted to even talk about, and it's kind of its own conversation. But what I want to say is simply that the perspective that I want to take, that I'm trying to take relative to this, is just that my sense is that there is, in many ways, technology, for lack of a better term, as you said, has taken some of the function that traditionally the arts might take. In other words, I'm feeling a bit like I have to unpack a lot of things that I don't quite feel prepared to unpack again, because this wasn't even the thing I wanted to say in this conversational turn. But that I think there's a tendency that we have to, or rather, we're in a situation where technology, in many ways, for better and for worse, has taken that integrative function in our society, and it in the sense that art does not have that same sort of macro spherological or integrative sort of function at a higher level that our technologies, our Facebooks and our sort of social media and infrastructures for sociality through technology has taken over that functionality. And I'm not necessarily making the claim I'm simply making the claim that things, that certain aspects of that technological infrastructure have the potential to be points of intervention. And the same, and it comes back to something that, that what you're talking about made me think of, which is something in the post-humanists in particular. Bruno Latour wrote a great article called Why Has Critique Run Out of Steam, where he's essentially making the same argument that I think you're making, John, which is that our academic, our mode of deconstructionism has become so dominant that we haven't, we've lost the ability to propose a reintegrative and reconstructionist kind of, you know, we've lost the ability to do reconstructionism. And as a result, what Latour is pointing out is that all of this deconstructionism and the deconstruction of sort of scientific practice that, that Latour and others are sort of responsible for and claiming responsibility for, at least within the academic realm, is what is leading to the global warming denialism and all these other kind of distorted versions of this sort of deconstructionist urge that has become dominant in society. So, I don't, again, I don't really know where I was going with that. I just wanted to say that I think that we have that, we have in our current situation technologies that further, further this sort of, I have a whole idea of a common thread, but I feel like that's maybe for later. And the common thread has to do with just the turning away, that the idea that when faced with the opportunity to connect with someone, when the turning away, when someone is, I think that this is the source of a lot of the alienation that leads to the rage and the shootings and so on, is when someone, and it's maybe starts with the mother and child relationship, but when you seek that response from the other and instead you get the other turning away or ignoring, I think that that's a common thread in a lot of pathologies that we're talking about at different levels, both with the mother and child, with the celebrity, and certainly with just day-to-day, you know, making connections. And the fact that when you don't turn away, when you have a chance to talk with someone and interact with someone directly, it creates the possibility for a resilient social bond, social capital, and the ability to change and overcome sort of prejudices or biases that would otherwise distort or further kind of perpetuate this process of us turning away from each other and scapegoating each other and creating a grotesque image of each other. Anyway, that's a lot of stuff, so I'll stop there.
My apologies, Nate, for interrupting. I'm sorry about that. I got a little carried away.
Sure, and I understand.
The hothouse. The hothouse effect. It's the greenhouse effect of the Zoom call.
If we could talk about... Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Marco. Sorry.
Oh, that's all. I do want to point out that we're kind of near the 90-minute mark. But if we want to take some time to cool off and to, you know, sort of continue unpacking a few more ideas, I'm available. If anybody needs to leave, this would be perhaps a good time. I'll stick on. I also want to make sure that I acknowledge Donna, who's been with us, and give her a chance to contribute to the conversation if she wishes to. You know, as we kind of go back and forth, and I think we're actually talking about substantial matters here. I realize that we can. You know, that we need to take our foot off the accelerator a little bit and just survey what we're really even trying to resolve. And one of those things is what is to be done, it seems, is the question. So I'll give, Donna, is there anything you'd want to say, or should we just, you know, continue? Looks like you're muted.
Hello? Yes,
can you
hear me? Yes. I just want to mention my reflections on this chapter. When I started reading chapter 2, I remembered a book I've read like 5 years ago. He is a Syrian author, and he was following the image of Ishtar in different civilizations. And it was a very interesting book because it's called The Riddle or The Mystery of Ishtar. So when I read this chapter, I felt it's in a way, for me, it was connected with that book. And another thing I want to comment at, it's I think towards the end of the chapter, he mentions about Lacan, the mirror stage, which I'd love to hear your reflections, how he's trying to in a way, I felt he's trying to connect between what Lacan mentioned in the mirror stage and where we come to realize the self and the reflection also, I mean, how this is connected to the chapter, if I can hear people comment on this. Thank you.
He does have a, if I may say, he does have a dismissive comment about Lacan, where he's talking about, sort of dismisses Lacan's idea of the formation of the ego as a result of the infant's interaction with the mirror as a cultural artifact, because Lacan didn't take into account that the proliferation of mirrors is really something that only happens in the 19th century, according to Sloterdijk, if this is correct, and that therefore the transcendental subject, the ego and so forth, the formation of the West's formation of the strong ego really predates the proliferation of mirrors by quite a few centuries. So that's how this chapter sort of dismisses Lacan without further ado.
He also talks about Narcissus, and you know, they didn't have mirrors. And Narcissus didn't know when he was gazing into his own reflection that it was his own reflection. I just quote him. He says, the Narcissian mishap constitutes an accident in the early stages of self-reflection. I think that's really interesting, how other people give us that sense of who we are. Now, of course, we do have mirrors, and we do have movies, and we have photographs, and we have all kinds of other ways of viewing ourselves. And I think we often take a third-person relationship to ourselves that's making things very complex and maybe dysfunctional. But I just wanted to add that I think at the end of the chapter, after he traces this these different phases of development, that he talks about being alone, the human wants to and is meant to have the ability to be alone. And this is what I'm dealing with right now. I mean, I like being alone. I love my solitude. I don't know that I want to give it up for anybody right now. That wasn't true a decade ago. Or when I was much younger, I would give up my time alone for anybody else's trouble or anybody else's drama. I got really sucked into it, and I was attracted and drawn to people who had lots of dramas. And I think there's it's really a liberation when you can be alone and enjoy being alone. And I think the challenge is, can we be alone together? Can we have relationships with people who also enjoy being alone, rather than loners? And I think that's the trouble that a lot of people are having, is they're not really comfortable with being alone. They're becoming loners. And there's a fine line there. And I'm not necessarily, I don't know that I've resolved this. All I know is I love being alone. I love my solitude. I love to read. I love to write. And I also like to hang out with people who enjoy going a little bit deeper. But I don't need those, you know, those butt-sniffing contests where people sit around having cocktails talking about how fabulous they could be or want to be or used to be. I mean, you know, give me a break. And I think that's probably one of the advantages, I think, to some of our social media, is we can be a little bit selective about who we want to hang out with, rather than just going out into a social space and hoping you collect some people who, you know, you find attractive or interesting. So anyway, that's where I think my cutting edge is how can I create healthy relationships through the social media that isn't driven by nefarious hidden parties? And how can I reactivate, being in real-time physical spaces with people where you share an environment in real time? And I live in New York. I mean, I see millions of people every day. And I see more and more people are looking into their devices than they are to the person that they're with. I think that's going to be very challenging for the next generation. For my people in my generation, I think it's also very destabilizing. Anyway, just putting that out there. Thank you.
So, Michael, you at one point wanted to make a comment. I want to invite you to do so. Ed, I haven't heard from you too much. if you'd like to say anything, but then let's wrap it up, I'd say. I might make just say a couple of words about this conversation because I'm reflecting on it right now and just have a couple of closing thoughts.
Okay. I have just actually, it's a thing for you and for John, Ebert. Since you both read Mention Park, Zoo, whatever, that was the piece that got Habermas to accuse Sloterdijk of being fascistoid. What in there caused Habermas to think that? I haven't read it. I don't know. And it's just one of these things. It's a side issue to this whole thing. How did that come up? What is in there that so provoked Habermas to react so negatively towards Sloterdijk? That would interest me personally. It has nothing to do with our conversation as it is. The other thing is that Johnny just mentioned he lives in New York and there's millions of people and they're all staring at the phones and everybody's kind of isolated. I live in a very small rural German community, 3,000 people in 7 villages who come together. And one of the villages that makes up our community is called Fischbach, which just means the fish stream. And in the fish stream, there's no internet. It's completely isolated. You can't get a mobile signal there. If you want to talk to someone by electronically, you have to use a telephone and you have to call a landline. You can't use your mobiles there. They're completely isolated from everything. It's probably the happiest village that I know in my community because they're not taken up by all of this. And there is something about our technology that we use that is so enabling. You know, I get to meet people like you, all of the people here in this conversation. I love all you guys. It's great that I can like interface and see and hear and listen. And I'm sorry for being rude myself, John, for telling you you're being rude. It's all in the heat of the discussion, but it's all part of who we are. And as I've noted on a number of our written threads in accompanying to this, I don't think we know who we are. I think we're sometimes afraid to acknowledge who we are. We don't want to really recognize who we are because doing that entails a huge burden. And this is the burden of being human to me, if I can say it that way. And this burden of being human means I have to really think long and hard about everything I say and every effect that I might have on another human being that I encounter in some way. And this is an enormous responsibility. And what bothers me about a lot of the talks that we have about theories and this guy thought this and art historically, we get this, that, and whatnot coming into it, is that we lose sight of the fact that it's still me somehow that's in there. And I'm still the one that has to deal with it. And I'm still the one that has to come to terms with it. And I can only do that as long as I got other folks like you who are there to help me sort that out. I can't do it as much as I love. Believe me, Johnny, I know I love being alone. I love sitting in the middle of nowhere where nobody can get to me.
You know, and it's not just who we are or who am I, but where are we? I think we talked about
can also
I don't know where I am anymore. I know who I am, but I don't know where I am.
Yeah, I know exactly.
I'm located right now. I have no idea.
Yeah. And that's important to me because, well, we are only where we are whenever we are. and here we are. That's all I have to say.
Cool. Michael, last chance before we wrap this up. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, it was about art. And I loved, John Ebert, your
discussion of the dilemma of both mass cultural and advanced art. And I think that's it's a hugely interesting discussion. And I would just throw in quickly Walter Benjamin's essay, where he charts a history where these earlier modes of art, these pre-modern contexts of art, where he called ritual values, where art was not its own autonomous, semi-autonomous sphere, its own subsystem. And it had the effect of actually reproducing unjust power relationships. So there may have been master signifieds, but for Benjamin, these master signifieds were always, in some sense, oppressive in some sense. And then, of course, Adorno disagreed with Benjamin and so on. And then he actually saw this emergence of mass cultural art as actually the greatest possibility. And what you're saying is it's actually decayed into a kind of modeling violence as a way out. And the last piece, it's a big discussion, just throwing some fragments. Someone like Malevich, I mean, you got me to think, you know, yeah, there is a deconstructive element to this. There is. Because of this modern impulse to break with the past and be modern, to focus on the future and to break with convention. So he's, you know, breaking from even earlier modernist enterprises. But there's another gesture there, and I think it's essentializing, that he's actually seeking for something through an abstract language that bypasses linguistic differences, bypasses religious differences, and is seeking something more universal, a universal language. I'm not saying it is. He's seeking universal language to signify something like a witnessing consciousness or a non-duality or something like that. And but I hadn't really thought about that there's also a deconstructive dimension and a destructive dimension to it. So I really appreciate that. Yeah. I think the art question is fantastically interesting, and I hope we pursue that. So a few fragments.
Yeah. Just to pick up on that and wrap it up, I want to reiterate Nate's point as well. What I think that he was trying to say, because I think Nate, you may not have felt like you were able to quite get it out, but I think I saw where you were going with that. And it came out of a question that to me was very practical, which, you know, roughly put would be, you know, our spheres are obliterated in some sense because of the disruptive effects of media and social media. In times past, art would have that sphere-forming, stabilizing, civilizing effect. That's no longer the case now. And the popular art that we have can further entrains negative patterns. I'm maybe just chopping up and summarizing your point, John. And so what is it that can provide that function, perform that role? And what is the response that may be arising through us, more broadly through other initiatives, other communities, other people who are grappling with the same issues? And I think that one thing that Nate brought into it is that there's a quality of conversation. There's a quality of facing each other and staying with each other, staying in a conversation that you know, this media both enables and it also subverts, because it subverts in a certain way. Because if you're in a small town, you can't really escape each other. If I want to escape you right now, I could flip off my phone, press a button, and you're gone. You're as good as ghosts to me, and you will exist in this spectral fashion for me. So given the fact that the technology allows us to do that, how do we use it in a way, and how perhaps even do we encode it in a way that inclines toward the depth of conversation and communion and being withness that is so needed, that that I think we feel the need for, because we're human and because we're alive. So I appreciate, Ed, you're bringing it to that point too, because the ones who are here now are us. We're here now talking about this. Sloterdijk is as good as a figment. Right? His text is markings on a page until we bring it to life through our dialogue. And you know, every time we do a talk like this, I'm worried beforehand whether people will show up, whether it'll be good, you know, whether I'll make a fool of myself, say something stupid, etc. And like all those layers of reflexivity are operative, you know, in my psyche coming into it, and you know, the awkwardness of dealing with screens and keyboards and crap, you know, exacerbates those dynamics. But I do want to express appreciation for you all being here and for, you know, week after week continuing the conversation, because I think it's important. Like for me, it's urgent that we do this kind of work, not necessarily us specifically now, you know, in a world important way, but that we hold a clear, that clearing, that interfacial and that interontological or whatever, that the intersubjective clearing, to me, that's a really important thing to be doing. And it's, you know, I feel pretty clumsy in the way that we're sort of handling all this, because it's you know, an unstable, you know, we're dealing with unstable platforms overall, and we just haven't done it very much. I don't think we know how that well. So we're learning. But I do appreciate you all being here. And I really want to thank you all. So you know, we're only two chapters into this too, ways to go. So I hope we'll stick it through.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Marco.
Thank you, everybody.
Yeah.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you
all.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed that.
Been a lot of fun.
Good. Good. All right. Well, 2 weeks from now. Same bat channel, same bat station.
Okay, we'll give it a try.
All right, bye-bye, everyone.